I am going to get to read the AA preamble. That's a dream come true. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I tried that a long time, and I'm not very good at it. The Al-Anon preamble. The Al-Anon family groups are a fellowship of relatives and friends of alcoholics who share their experience, strength, and hope in order to solve their common problems. We believe alcoholism is a family illness and that changed attitudes can aid recovery. Al-Anon is not allied with any sect, denomination, political entity, organization, or institution. Does not engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any cause. There are no dues for membership. Al-Anon is self-supporting through its own voluntary contributions. Al-Anon has but one purpose, to help families of alcoholics. We do this by practicing the 12 steps, by welcoming and giving comfort to families of alcoholics, and by giving understanding and encouragement to the alcoholic. The format today, this is our speaker panel, and they're each going to talk about 15 or 20 minutes on the conference theme, which always is the spiritual life is not a theory, you have to live it. So, and if there's time when they're done, we will take some questions. So, first off the bat is our Wednesday night speaker, Palmer.
Thank you, Alan. My name is Palmer Graves. I am a grateful Al-Anon. I had to pinch hit for Alan one time, and I tell you what, that's a tough job pinch hitting for Alan. So, I couldn't do it, but I did what I could. So, I'm the baby amongst all these spiritual giants here that will follow, so I'm grateful to be here. I used to, when I first came in, and I heard you talking about this spiritual awakening that we're going to have. I've got this ego that I kind of think that I ought to get knocked off the back of a horse by a bolt of lightning and all that, and for me that hasn't happened. I remember calling my sponsor one time, and I said, when am I going to get my spiritual awakening? And it's just not happening. And he started laughing, and he said, Palmer, I want you to think about 2 weeks before you crawled into Al-Anon, what was it like that day? And it's like, oh, God, I don't want to think about that. And he said, okay, so what is it like today? And it's like, oh, wow. It's the frog story that Beth was talking about. If we, you turn up the heat incrementally, we get into our disease incrementally, and we'd never notice that we're getting disease because it's a little chunk at a time. Well, if you turn that around, my experience is that's how we have our spiritual awakening, is a little chunk at a time. And the only way that I could see it was mentally comparing what I was like before I came into what I'm like today. And I can see then that these steps work. It's just that they work. Because it took me from there to here, and there's no road in between except those 12 steps that I know of. Because I have the ego I do, thinking that I ought to be doing these great things and stuff, I have to keep it simple. For me, the spiritual tools are very simple. I've got to go to meetings. I can't go more than 2 days without a meeting. Or I start, my character defects start coming out, and I just start going downhill. I need meetings. I remember calling my sponsor one time again, and I was whining about, why do I have to go to 5 meetings a week? Normal people don't. And again, he picked himself off the floor laughing, and he said, well, Palmer, you're not normal. It's like, oh, yeah, thank you for reminding me. But I just have to go to meetings. And so, I mean, there's six things that I've been given through pretty much by my sponsorship line is to, you know, go to meetings, get a sponsor. I've got to have a sponsor. You know, my sponsor became unavailable. He was in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's in the military. And there are months at a time where I can't get a hold of him. And so I called my grand sponsor and I said, would you sponsor me? Well, Steve's not available. And so Vinoy graciously did. And so I have to be accountable to somebody. Because when I'm off the beam, I'm off the beam. And I don't know I'm off the beam because I'm off the beam. That's what Pat Clayer used to say. I love that expression. Because, you know, my thinking becomes distorted by trying to force solutions. That's what it says in our opening. I have a thinking disorder and I become unreasonable and without knowing it. Irritable and unreasonable without knowing it. And so I need to talk to a sponsor. So I go to meetings, have a sponsor, I work the steps with my sponsor. I still do step work. You know, I've been in the program 21 years now, and I still, every day, do the 10th, 11th, 12th step. I still have to get out my pen and paper and write it down in black and white. Can't think about it because I have a thinking disorder. I have to write it out. I have to take commitments. You know, when my group opens up, I'm there setting up chairs right now, and then I'm on the greeting committee. I love greeting. You know, I stand out in front and shake hands of everybody that comes in. If I don't have a commitment to the meeting or a commitment somewhere, I don't show up, you know. And so when I have a commitment, I've got to be there. I started out at washing ashtrays when, you know, this was back when you smoked at meeting. Whether you smoked or not, you still smoked because it was so thick. But I love taking commitment because that keeps me in the middle. And if I'm in the middle, I don't fall off the edge. I work with others. You know, I sponsor a lot of guys and over the years. And so by giving away, I get to keep some of the serenity that it gives me. So I think that's really important as well. The sixth thing is I pray on my knees. You know, I hit my knees in the morning and at night, I heard somebody call it knee mail not long ago. I love that expression. You know, I've got to do knee mail. Those six things are really simple tools that I just keep practicing, and that's pretty much what it is that made the road from there to here. A simple set of rules for tools for a complex person. And, you know, if I get in my head, I can think it out where it's got to be something really complex. But it's spelled out quite plainly in the big book, you know, about what we do in the morning at night, page 87. And I just try to follow that. You know, the prayer of guide my thinking, help that it be divorced from self-pity or self-seeking and dishonest motives. That's pretty important to me. Somehow, when I do these things, I seem to have an intuitive sense of what's the next right thing to do. And I think for me, it's that simplicity of just doing that. I intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle me. The promise is coming true in my life of just doing these simple things. So I think I'm going to sit down and let the next person get up. Thank you so much.
Spiritual Chuck, an alcoholic. I brought a bigger cup today. But one last night ran out. My name's Chuck Hartley, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Chuck.
Just tickles the heck out of me that somebody would ask me to come up here and speak about the spiritual life that I get to lead today. It's just overwhelming, really. I've been blessed in sobriety. I've always had a sponsor who has always had a sponsor. And I've almost always sponsored other men. And the spiritual life for me begins with sponsoring other men. You know, I just, I feel closer to my Creator when I am asked by someone else to take them through the steps, and I get to do that. I get to see all of the new things that have been written in the big book since the last time I read it. I brought a cheat sheet. I used to drink a lot. Memory comes and goes. But the spiritual life for me is not sitting in a meeting. It's not reading the steps. It's taking the steps. And step 12 tells me that I'm going to have a spiritual awakening as a result of taking these steps. And I have taken everything that you folks in the big book have told me in 22 years of sobriety on faith, and it has never failed me. And my spiritual awakening was, of course, of the educational variety. I wasn't one of the lucky ones that felt the wind blow through. But the appendix in the big book, appendix 2, about a spiritual awakening, that can be called the awareness of the presence of God. And so step 12 says to me that, having become aware of the presence of God as a result of these steps, these other 11 steps, I have to take them all. I'm not going to, I didn't anyway, have a spiritual experience at step 3. All I did at step 3 was make a spiritual decision to follow through with the rest of the steps. And, step 4, I wrote that inventory that we all dread. And step 5, shared it with another man who, as you guys heard me talk last night, called me on my stuff and challenged me with the 3 things that I had kept secret. And I told them to him and moved on to steps 6 and 7, where I'm willing to do something versus wanting to do something. I can be willing. I'm willing right now, actually, for God to take the pain out of my body and let me lose 100 pounds and and maybe eat right. But if I don't go to the gym and practice some table pushaways, I'm not going to get any results. I have to want to do those things, and I have to take that action there. And and steps 8 and 9, the amends that I made, the result of those amends, I can go anywhere in the world and look everyone that I see there in the eye. I'm straight with the courts. I'm straight with my parents. I'm straight with my brothers. I'm straight with people that I harm knowingly and unknowingly. And in step 11, I get to practice the presence of God on a regular basis in my life. Just driving around town and seeing a little AA bumper sticker makes me think of God and all of you people and the blessings that I've been given. And as a result of the steps there, my prayers begin to change. And I begin to change. I think less of me and more of you. When I tell people I'm going to pray for them, I don't just forget about them and move on. I actually ask them right there if they want me to pray with them. And that's so much growth for me, because I could have cared less about any one of y'all when I first came to AA. And by practicing this spiritual way of life, it's not a theory. I have been able to grow as a result of this program and as a result of these steps. And I get to practice these principles in all of my affairs, The principles that are talked about over and over again in our book, honesty, hope, faith, courage, integrity, willingness, humility, love, patience, discipline, and service. That's some very strong promises. And it's the type of work that you all have challenged me to do that makes me want to grow, not just be willing to grow. You know, I get to practice this in all of my affairs at home. You know, I don't yell and scream at my wife. She doesn't yell and scream at me. You know, we'll have a difference of opinion, of course. But we just found early on that we don't have any growth as a family when we're acting out like that. And, you know, at work, you know, I may be the only big book that my coworkers ever see. And if I go to work and act like I don't want to be there, they're going to see that. And when I tell them I'm in AA, if it ever comes up, they're going to think, big deal. Why should I care about AA? And I get to practice these principles right here in AA. You know, one of the biggest things that I've found in AA that'll kill a meeting quicker than anything is gossip. And I don't practice gossip. It's not healthy. It doesn't do me any good, nor does it do the person that I would be talking about any good either. Just in driving or going to the store or something, you know. I mean, I was one of those left-handed drivers that was always out the window, you know, when you cut me off the wrong way. And I got AA bumper stickers on my car. So, you know, if I'm driving like that, you know, what kind of example am I setting for people who don't have any exposure to our program? You know, if I'm shopping at the store and the clerk's having a bad day and I try to take it out on her so that I can exert some sort of superiority over him or her, you know, what do I get out of that? I don't get anything at all. So I always ask people that are waiting on me how they're doing, how their day's going, you know, because, you know, if you've ever worked in a service industry, it can be difficult. And I don't know what kind of life that they're leading that would bring them into work that day and they'd be having a bad day and take it out on me. And I don't let them because I'm not going to play. I've been taught better. I'm going to read something from the big book that talks about the spiritual life and it not being a theory, and I'm going to shut up. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. Just the simple fact of God has worked in my life so that I can read something like this is powerful enough. Thank you.
Thank you, Jesus.
My name is Beth Hartley. I'm an alcoholic. So by the grace of God, sponsorship, steps, and fellowship since June 26, 1988. And, that thing Chuck read, I always wonder, it's funny because sometimes words can go either way. And I'm kind of putting this out there as a question, but tell me later, don't raise your hands now. Because when I read it, it says, He has entered our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. So just a little food for thought later. Chuck touched on that problem with being married as long as we have, as we kind of unconsciously give each other's talks sometimes. So I have to start over now. but I want to talk, because the steps and stuff are getting covered, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, living the spiritual life outside of the meetings. Because, you know, one of the things the Big Book says is that we can't just, that a much more important demonstration at home and other places lies ahead of us. And some of the very first things they told, things I didn't know were spiritual, were, you know, because my sponsor told me making your bed is a spiritual act. And, You know, I was like, yeah, okay, if you say so. But I just, you know, I didn't want to drink anymore, so I started making my bed. But I'll tell you, when I would come home at the end of a day and there was a made bed there, it just, it was nice. And I just, you know, the, show up, be where you say you'll be when you say you'll be there is a spiritual principle. This is where I learned to show up. This is where my word became worth something. And, you know, if I am a spiritual giant in the meeting, and then I go home and scream at my kids and, you know, treat my mother with contempt because she and I are both a bit self-willed, strong-willed, and so there could be a little clashing every now and then, you know, and I do have a coffee mug that says, it's official, I've become my mother, and I sent it to Sarah a couple years ago. But, you know, I realized at 5 or 6 years sober that I worked with my mom every day, and I was just kind of a jerk to her on a regular basis. I mean, we'd be okay within the perimeters of work, but one of the stories I tell sometimes when I'm doing workshops is that she would ask me to, I'd say I was going out for lunch, and she'd say, on your way back, will you stop by Jersey Mike's and get me a sandwich? And, well, for God's sakes, Jersey Mike's was not on my way back. You know, we worked here, I was going here, and Jersey Mike's was here. Now, you got to understand, it's probably 2 miles from here to here, but it's still, it is not on the way, technically, and she said, on the way. And, you know, so I would do it, but I'd give her the big sigh, and I'd bring in her, here's your sandwich, and just, you know, just to be sure she knew how put upon I was to have to do this for her. And one day, I heard somebody say they started out in family relationships asking themselves, you know, well, what would you say if you liked her? I hope you weren't looking for a spiritual giant up here. That might be one of these two. It's not me. And that's really, honest to God, that's where I started with my mother, is what would you do, what would you say if you liked her? And, or what would you say if she was anybody but your mother? If anyone else asked you to do that, you would be gracious. And so I made a commitment to myself that if she asked me, you know, to go get on my way, that I would just say, I'd be glad to. So I laid the trap and said, I'm going to run home at lunch. And she, of course, said, on your way back, will you get the sandwich? And I said, I'll be glad to. And for the next 2 or 3 weeks, when she asked, I said I'd be glad to. And somewhere along the line, I realized that I was glad to do it. And another week or so after that, I heard myself saying, hey, I'm going out at lunch. Can I bring you something back? And the only thing that had changed, and that's where I go to with step 6 and 7, is that I take the action and God changes my heart. And it's how I got sober too. Because I can get all caught up in, well, I'm praying to be willing and I guess God just hasn't made me willing yet. But you know what that translates to after about 30 days of sober is, when I woke up today, I didn't want to. So I guess God hasn't done it. And you know, when I got sober, I did a lot of stuff I didn't want to do. I went to meetings, I called my sponsor, I read the book. I just did it anyway. And so I have to remember that part of the spiritual life and in willingness, you know, if I wanted to do it, I wouldn't need to be willing. You know, willingness is doing it anyway. And I started building a relationship with my mother just kind of one good manner at a time, respecting my elder. You know, what would I say to her if she was someone else's mother? And it's been a long road. I was probably 17 years sober before I could say that I love my mother and feel anything besides a sense of duty. You know, I had gotten to where I could love her out of a sense of duty. And then somewhere 17, 18 years sober, I got that, you know, that love in my heart. So if you're out, somebody out there must have mother issues today, because I wasn't really planning on talking about this. But but there you have it. It does get better. It takes a very long time sometimes. You know, I started showing up with my children. I stopped making promises I couldn't keep. And a friend of mine, when my daughter was young, she was a friend of mine was a single mom. And she said, well, you know, we took them to the meeting about being little brownies, you know, the pre-Girl Scouts. And my friend Joni said, well, why don't we be brownie leaders so we can spend time with the girls? And I'm thinking, oh, hell no, you know? But I said, sure, because, you know, of course, I had a whole card, which was I'd been arrested for child endangerment, you know, a while back. So I figured that I could look really willing. And then they'd say I couldn't. And I'd say, oh, so sad. I tried. So I filled out all the paperwork, and a couple weeks later, I get my letter, and it says, congratulations, and welcome to the Great Rivers Girl Scout Council. And I just thought, what? You know? But what happened was, we took the girls, and Joni didn't camp, but I, you know, we took the girls overnight camping, and these were first and second grade girls. And as we were getting ready to leave, some of the moms, you know, were bringing their girls and telling them goodbye, and they're coming up and thanking me. And I realized some of these girls had never been away from home overnight. And their mothers were trusting me to take their most precious little children away overnight. And that, you know, 3 or 4 years before, I couldn't even take my own children overnight. And that was purely the result, not of just going to meetings, because if I just went to meetings and went home, you know, nothing else would have changed, but that they saw me out there as a parent and a member of the community and as a citizen, like Chuck talked about last night. And several years later, the church youth group came to me, and they were scouting a new youth camp down in, it was in Panama City Beach in a hotel on the ocean. That is my kind of youth camp. And and they rented us a car. They wanted me to go down with the youth leadership, and they paid the trip. And so now I'm getting, you know, asked to take other people's children across state lines, you know. It's like you just never know what's going to happen if you keep showing up. But that's, you know, that's not something I would have ever dreamed would happen, that people would, you know, not only ask me to do things, but trust me with their children. You know, I took the youth leadership that first year, and the next year we took 22 kids. Ranging from 7th grade to 12th grade, from Cincinnati down to Panama City Beach. And, you know, that's the result of living this life outside the walls of AA. I'm always like, Chuck, I have an AA sticker on my car. Actually, my license plates say, Yay, God. And and that keeps me honest when I'm driving, because I cannot cut you off, flip you off, and then leave you with Yay, God, you know, as a... I'm, you know, running you down. And so, you know, some days it's a true expression of how I feel, and other days it just makes me drive better than I want to. But, you know, I am a citizen on the road, and I had an experience early in sobriety where I was parking, or my first home group was downtown in Cincinnati, and so there was a pay parking lot right across the street from the church, and I always parked there, and I kind of had my space. And if there was a Reds game, you had to go early. So I went early one day because of the Reds game, and the kid working wanted me to park over there, but I park over here. This, you know, this is my space. And we kind of went back and forth, and finally he, you know, said, please park over there. So I, fine, you know, so I wheeled my car over, and I got it, and I slammed my car door, and I flounced by, you know, because we can flounce, can't we? And it stomped across the street to go be spiritual in my home group. And so this particular church, it was in a basement, and there was a wheelchair ramp down, and we lined both sides of it to greet people coming in. It was like a gauntlet. If you were new, you had to kind of get through. And I'm shaking, welcome to East 4th Street, welcome, 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 welcome. And one of the hands I shook didn't let go, and this voice said, oh, we've met. And I looked up, and you know, it was the parking lot guy. And for whatever reason, it was one of those moments of grace where I realized, you know, what if this had been his first meeting? And I had just been a complete jerk out there. And, you know, and I mean, I'm an accountant. I count things. So I know if you have 15 items in the 12-item line, okay? I know you do. But if I take that out on the cashier, and then a week later she shows up in my home group as a new girl, is she going to want what we have? You know, I try to, like Chuck, to just be pleasant, you know, to be pleasant. Traveling brings out the worst in many of us. And, you know, getting home, that last leg of the trip where they pick you up in the van to take you to your car from the airport. And I have just made it a practice that when they pull up and step out, I just go, I am so glad to see you. Because, you know, and why wouldn't I be? They're the last guy. They're taking me to my car so I can go home. But there was a time when I would have just been, you know, he didn't get my suitcase fast enough, and how come we have to drop all of them off at their cars first, and blah, 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 you know? And now I can just say, God, it is so great to see you. I just always know I'm home when I see you, you know? And little things like handing money to the cashier instead of throwing it on the counter, you know? All of those hundred little things, because we are the only big book that people see. And if I'm, you know, if I am showing my butt out there, I cannot be of use to any of those people if they come in here. And thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. My name's Deb. I'm a real alcoholic.
Hi, Deb. Hi.
Oh, it's great to be here. It's horrible to follow these guys, though. Remind me to go first next time, no matter how nervous I am. I stole all my good stuff. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. My sobriety date is March 15th, 1987. And I was born and raised drunk and got sober right outside of Akron, Ohio. And in Akron, Ohio, that was the last place where the members of what would become Alcoholics Anonymous actually broke away from the Oxford groups. New York broke away first. Cleveland broke away from Akron because they didn't like the association with the Oxford groups. And then, you know, finally they convinced Dr. Bob that God would work well enough with just Alcoholics Anonymous, and they didn't need to be as tightly connected with the Oxford groups as they were. But there are some things that are a little stubborn up in the Akron area, and there are some of the tools that came from the Oxford groups that they held on to, even though it's not conference approved and all of those kinds of things. And one set of tools that they kept and that they gave me very, very early on were the four absolutes. And those are the four spiritual pillars left over from the Oxford groups. And still today, if you go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous up in the Akron area and sometimes in the Cleveland area, instead of seeing, you know, think, or but for the grace of God or one of those things, one of those will be replaced with the four absolutes. And they'll be hanging on the podium. And the four absolutes are absolute honesty, unselfishness, love, and purity. And when I was getting sober, I wanted to work the steps very quickly because I wasn't allowed to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous until I'd worked my 12 steps. My sponsor had said, you know, we go to meetings to talk about the solution. You have no idea what that's about, and you won't be spreading your disease. So I wanted to talk at meetings. That's all I wanted to, I had nothing to say, but I wanted to talk. And they said no. So I went to my sponsor and I said, when are we going to get started on these steps? We have to get started on these steps. And she said, and she just looked at me and she said, you need to go figure out what the four absolutes are first. And until you know what those are, then we're not getting started on the steps. And I had seen the placard. And so I wrote down the four words and I went and looked them up in the dictionary. And I went back to her and I had the definitions of what unselfishness was and a definition for what love was and a definition for what purity was. And I said, and so I offered those to her. And she said, that's not what I'm looking for. And so I was allowed to go to discussion meetings. We didn't have a lot of them. But I was allowed to go to discussion meetings, get there early, and ask the chairperson to bring up a topic for me. But I wasn't allowed to comment on the topic. And so I started going to some extra meetings and going to the meetings early. And I would ask the chairperson to bring up the topic of the four absolutes for me. And so they would do that. And they did that several times. And one of the old guys in the meeting, who my sponsor used to argue with out loud, he pulled me over to the side after a meeting and he said, are you still trying to figure out what the four absolutes are? I said, yes, sir, I am. And he said, well, he said, you know that they're love, honesty, purity, and unselfishness. I said, I know. I've told her what the definitions are, but that's not good enough. And he said, those are the things that we put in place of our character defects. He said, we're going to turn in our character defects and we're going to replace them with love, honesty, purity, and unselfishness. He said, those are the goals of recovery. He said, if everything you do, if it's loving, if it's of pure motive, if it's unselfish, and if it's honest, it's right, it's of God, and you're allowed to do it. And I went running back to my sponsor and I said, well, the four absolutes, those are the goals of recovery. Those are the things I'm going to put in place of my character defects when we get to step 6 and 7. And she said, that damn Mac, I knew he'd tell you. And I'm so grateful. I am so grateful today. We were talking about this in the workshop yesterday on step 6 and 7. But I'm so grateful that I got started in my recovery with these four absolutes. I'm so grateful because what it did was it introduced me to spiritual concepts without making me tackle the idea of God first. Because I came in here and I was terrified of God. And I knew that God hated me. And if there was a God, he was going to have nothing to do with me. There was nothing but negative between me and this whole concept and idea of God. And so before I even got into the steps, I was introduced to spiritual principles. And I was introduced to behavior that was spiritual. I started trying. It was ugly, but I started trying to practice the principles in all of my affairs, even though I had no idea what I was doing. And what I can tell you is that today, I still run especially tough decisions. I keep holding up my card. The four absolutes are on here. I still run a lot of my tough decisions through these four questions. Is it loving? Is it pure? Is it unselfish? And is it honest? And if it fails any of those, then I need to pause. And I need to go to God in prayer, and I need to sit quietly in meditation and see if there's a different way that he would have me go. And it's been a really, really long spiritual journey, and I'm not going to tell all of you all of it right now because you have to come back at 8 o'clock. If I get up here and there's a half-empty room, I'll just be devastated. So, my favorite priest, I became Catholic some years ago, and you'll hear that story later too. Just a little hook. But my favorite priest, he's a Franciscan. His name is Father Targonski. We call him Father Ski. And he's just one of these guys who absolutely was selected by God to demonstrate God on this earth. And he's just so joyful, and he bounces around, and he's just an amazing man. And he came back from doing a retreat for nuns. He's a Franciscan, and he went to do a retreat for Franciscan nuns. And he told the story that he was in the hotel, the friary, wherever they were. And there was an older nun, and she was waiting on the elevator. She'd punched the button, but it was up several floors, and so she had sat down on a bench because she was very elderly. And he sat next to her, and he said, "You know, sister, how are you?" And she said, "Well, you know, Father, I'm doing just fine." And she was celebrating 80 years of being a nun. She was 98 years old. Yeah, and she had started in the old school where, you know, you could go to the convent when you were 2 or whatever. And, you know, she had been a nun her entire life, 80 years. And Father said, "Well, sister, isn't that just amazing that you have been that faithful for 80 years?" And she patted his knee, and she said, "Oh, Father, you have that so wrong. It is he who has had faith in me for 80 years, not me in him." And he told that story, and I tell you what, it flew all over me. And I mean, I had goosebumps from the top of my head to the tip of my toes. And that was such a gift to me, because what I realized is that is absolutely true. God has been in my life, and he has been faithful to me when I haven't even remembered that he is with me. I didn't even look around to see if he was there. I didn't pray. I didn't talk to him. I didn't consider what he would have me do. I felt very alone. I was being self-reliant. I was in character defect. Doesn't matter. You know, everything negative. But God never, ever has left me. He remains faithful to me when I find it terribly humanly difficult to be faithful to him. And that's such a gift to me. I work for the United States Marine Corps. And so, you know, I have a type A personality. I'm incredibly driven. And I've met my match. Oh, yeah. I used to, you know, work with people who weren't Marines, and I could just absolutely steamroll over anyone. And I hit the Marine Corps, and it was, you know, done, because I work with people who are exactly like me, only highly trained killers. So there may be one leg up. But 2.5 years ago, I started working for them, and I had to build a program from scratch. And it was a program that they didn't want. But the Department of Defense said, you will do this because it's for domestic activity. And the Marine Corps, they do what they do, and then they fight other places. They don't do domestic stuff. But I was hired because there's this directive that all Marine Corps installations are going to have this domestic focus in this one area, and so I have to build this thing for them. And they really don't want it. And so I'm starting from the ground up, and I'm meeting with all the high-level leaders and explaining to them and showing them the documentation that says you got to have it. And so I've been through many, many cycles, and every day when I go to work, it's like I put on my armor and I get ready to fight. And that's very dangerous. That's very dangerous for me as an alcoholic, because what I do is I tune up my ego. That's when I'm getting ready to fight, I'm tuning up my ego. And so for me, every single day, when I start to pull in that front gate and I feel like I'm getting armed for battle, I have to start talking to God, and I have to talk myself out of the armor so that I can go to work and do his work well. You know, just because the Department of Defense said we had to do it, and there's documentation, and I've been hired to do it, and I have to go up against these personalities that are just as big and as bold and as directive as mine, does not mean that it's not work that God gave me to do. And so I have to pray my way through that. And in this one particular circumstance, not that long ago, I'm ashamed to say, there's a particular lieutenant colonel, and he and I, we just oil and water. Absolute oil and water. We were just absolutely just pounding heads. He didn't want to do anything at all that I needed him to do. And so he would make me promises, and then he'd avoid me. And then when the deadline would come, he would make me a new promise, and then he'd avoid me, and he wouldn't get anything done. And he and I were absolutely at each other's throats. And I was acting as badly as he was, but I was justified. It's very important. If you're going to act badly, be justified. And so, and I was absolutely just, and it was just, we weren't getting anywhere. And I knew that it was me that was going to have to change. I know that it's my job to change because I live the spiritual life today. Anytime something's unacceptable to me, it's up to me to figure out how to change so that it can be different. And so I opened up my calendar and I saw that he was on it, and I thought, I got him today, 9 a.m. Oh, what a way to start my day. And immediately I started to pray, because I had actually started doing a daily 10th step on this process and on this person, and I was sharing it with one of the women that I sponsored every morning. And so when I looked at his name in the book and went, ugh, not him, I started to pray, and I said, God, I really need to be able to see him as one of your children. I really, really need to be able to see him differently. I need to be able to remember that this is work that you've given me to do, and I'm having this constant prayer and this constant conversation. He comes into my office. He actually shows up that time, and he sits down, and we start to work, and it's just going badly like it does every single time. And so I just sat, and I paused. It says, pause when agitated. I sat there, and I paused, and I went, and he said, are you okay? And I said, God, I need your help now. And what I heard God say was, be honest with him. And I looked at him and I said, Lieutenant Colonel Busby, I'm working really hard to see you as a precious child of God, therefore one of my brothers. And it's not working. You continue to do the same thing over and over. I continue to have the same reaction to it. Therefore, we're at a dead stop. It's going to reflect badly on both of us, and I'm not really sure how to get over this. My ego has my feet nailed to the floor. And he looked at me, and he said, what? And I said, don't make me repeat that. And it made him sit back, and he paused. And I think that's what we needed, was a pause. And he said, then let's do this differently. I'm going to walk out of your office. I'm not going to accept any deadlines from you. I'm going to go create something. I'm going to ask you to trust that I'm going to do it. And I'll call you when I'm done, and I'll invite you over to look at the product. I said, okay, you got a deal. And he said, but you have to leave me alone. I said, I will leave you alone. He said, fine. He got up and left, and 2 weeks later he called me and he said, come on over. And he showed me the product. He had his entire team put together, and they had created not only what I wanted, but what I needed. And it was better than what I could have made him create. If I didn't have a relationship with God, and if I didn't understand that my very ability to breathe is directly connected to my spiritual fitness and the relationship that I practice every day, there's no way I could have gotten there. There's no way I could have gotten there. We would have had to go see our general and sit in the general's office like two little wounded kids who couldn't get it done. Because that's where we were headed. We'd already been to the chief of staff. And you don't ever want to go to the commanding general because you can't get along. But that's where we were headed. But because the spiritual life is not a theory, we have to live it. And God said, be honest. And I laid it out for him. We were able to kind of get over that hump. You know, and I've got a million stories like that. And those are the kinds of things that I have to do every single day when I go to work. And it's hilarious because I have a closer, more intimate, deep, and effective relationship with God today than I ever would have without the United States Marine Corps. I mean, who knew? Really, who knew? And I think Chuck and Palmer were both talking specifically about sponsorship. And, you know, the women that I sponsor, I seem to get, many of us come to Alcoholics Anonymous and we have all kinds of hang-ups about God. We don't want to know God. We have issues from childhood about God. We have problems with our relationships with God, many of us. And I seem to get the women come into my life where just the very word God makes the hair stand up on the back of their neck and they don't want to hear anything about it. And I had experience. I moved to the Mojave Desert, which is where the base is where I work. I had moved out there 4 years ago. And there was the crop of newcomers that came in right about the time that I moved to town. And so three of those women are women that I get to work with in a very intimate and deep way in sponsorship. And one has another sponsor, but I'm her spiritual advisor. And they have watched me over the past couple of years. My entire AA community has watched me walk through some incredibly difficult things. And I've been brutally honest with them the entire way. You know, when I walk into a meeting and I'm not doing well and they say, how are you? I say, I'm not doing well. And I tell them why. And when I walk into a meeting and I'm doing okay and they ask me how I'm doing, I say, I'm doing okay. And when they ask me, how are you doing okay? I'll tell them because God loves me and I know it. That seems to be the key to everything in my life. And you know, one of those women who wouldn't even say the Lord's Prayer. She wouldn't even say the Lord's Prayer. She came up to me about 6 months ago, I guess. And she's the one that has called me her spiritual advisor. And she said, I want what you have. And I said, well, I'm not really sure what you mean. I mean, you've got, you know, you're 4 years sober and you're doing all these wonderful things. And she said, no, no, no. I want the relationship that you have with God. How do I get it? And I said, in order for you to have the relationship that I have with God, I said, the only way I know for you to get it is if you do exactly what I do. I said, and what I do flies against everything that you've ever wanted. Because she was the one that had the hair on the back of her neck stand up, and she wasn't joining an organized religion, and she wasn't going to pray like that. And I became Catholic 5 years ago, 5.5 years ago. And that process deepened my relationship with God. And I said, you know what I am. You know where I go and you know the things that I do. And she said, I don't care. I want it. And I said, are you sure about that? And she said, I am. And so she and her husband, they came up to me and they said, we're ready. We want the kind of relationship that you have with God. And so now they're becoming Catholic. And she's opened herself up to this very, very different spiritual walk than she was on before. And it wasn't because I told her she had to do it my way. It wasn't because I sponsor people of all different kinds of religions and all different kinds of spiritual walks. I mean, you know, I lived on your shirt tails in the, you know, free-floating spiritual ideas in Alcoholics Anonymous for 17 years before I took any measurable steps a different way. But she came up to me and she said, I want it and I'm willing to do whatever it's going to take. And I've watched her grow, and I've watched her husband grow. He's an Al-Anon. And I've watched their marriage heal just because they're willing to do it differently. So I don't know. I could stand up here and tell you stories forever, but I'm going to sit down because Mari is really great. Thank you.
My name's Mari and I'm an alcoholic. And my dry date is the 10th of August, 1984. You know, when I knelt down on the 10th of August, 1984, with this AA member to say the third step prayer, and I was released from the obsession to drink, I did not have any wind coming through like Bill did. I had absolutely no idea what had happened to me at that moment. In retrospect, I know that I had reached a place of absolute and complete despair, enough to give me an opening for God's grace. And I didn't understand all of it. But I was gung-ho in AA, and I could not believe that I did not want to drink anymore. It was a miracle to me. And then I started reading the big book, and it says, I am suffering from an illness for which there is only a spiritual experience can help, which means that I have a spiritual malady, which means that I have a spiritual sickness. The old timers used to call it a soul sickness, and I truly believe that I had a soul sickness. And I lived in the dark, and I had no place for God. I had written off God a long time ago. And I went on to read the big book, and in the big book it says, we have two choices. We can live life on a spiritual basis or die an alcoholic death. Is that it? can I think about that? But then it goes on a little bit more, and it says, we have to live a spiritual life. Or else. Now, every time in my life, people came and admonished me and said, you better do this or else. That or else would mean that I am doing that. And I would always come a cropper. Always. And they'd come back to me and said, see, I told you, you had to do that or else. And the or else always had terrible repercussions for me. So I wanted to do what the big book said, and I had no way to go about it. And it also talks in the big book about our seeming inability to accept much on faith. It always baffled me that my family had such faith. When I was young, I took it for granted that they had great faith. They were great Roman Catholics. They believed in God, and they lived their life accordingly. I never had faith. And I didn't know how to go about getting faith. And then I read Carl Gustav Jung, because I had spoken about him in the big book. And I remember hearing an old BBC interview with Jung. And I remember it like I just heard it. The person who was interviewing him said, do you believe in God? And there was a long pause. And you heard him sucking on his pipe. And then he said, I don't have to believe in God. I know. And I thought about that. And I know that Jung was a Gnostic. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C, Gnostic. And I went and because I was on my search, and Gnostics were a branch of Christianity that did not want faith. They wanted knowledge of God's existence. And it is said that Dalton Thomas, who wanted to put his fingers in God's hands, was a Gnostic, a Christian Gnostic. So he wanted knowledge of God. And I thought about that a lot. And I listened to a lot of AA stories and the pursuit of spirituality. And I realized, to me, I say, alcoholics, we're a bunch of Gnostics. It's almost like we had this seeming inability to have faith. A lot of us did. A lot of people had faith. But a lot of people I spoke to didn't have any faith. They found faith difficult. And I thought, you know, Mari, let's personalize it to you. You did not have faith. How are you going to come to believe in God? How did you get yourself on this path that took you so far away and separated you from God? Because that's what I was. I was separated from God. And I realized in some way I had been a Gnostic. I had said, I can't believe in you. I want proof. And if you be an alcoholic of my type and you drank the way I drank, then you know that you are beyond human aid. You see, I know without a shadow of a doubt that I was utterly and completely beyond human aid. And that is what Jung eventually told to Roland Hazard. Because, you know, it was Jung's humility that got us this program. Because when Roland Hazard said to him, have you never heard about an alcoholic getting well? Jung said, personally, I've never. I have never seen a single case where the illness exists like it does in you recover. Now, for a very brilliant man to say that, to me, is an act of humility. Jung was saying essentially, I don't have an answer for you. He said, but I have heard about them from time to time. And what happens is these people have huge emotional displacements where overnight they have a change of personality. And, you know, they spoke about the slow variety and the fast variety and whatever it was. I mean, you look at our beautiful co-founder, Bill Wilson. He had a spiritual awakening in Towns Hospital. So much so that when everything had done blowing around him, he said, so this is the God of the preachers. And a few months later, he was off thinking about having a drink kippoo in Akron when his deal went south, you know. So that spirituality obviously didn't carry him that far. So I had to find a way, and the only way I came that I could find this way, the spiritual life that the big book said I have to live, was to go through the big book and do what it told me to do in there. And I started off in a strange way. I remember this old woman. I said to her, how am I going to live this spiritual life? I have been such a terrible human being. She said, Mari, you stop doing the things you don't like yourself for, and you start doing the things that you do like yourself for. I had been selfish, self-centered, self will run riot. So let me take those three things and work on them. Let me start caring about other people. Let me start truly listening. You know, it is very difficult. I spent most of my life watching people's mouth move and nothing went in here. And I thought, let me start listening to people. Let me start being a force that is positive instead of a negative force in people's life. Let me start giving. And I started off slowly doing that. And I started off the AA way, in service. And at first it was just making the coffee. And because I had not been an honest person from where I came, they told me they used to give me the money to go and buy the pots of coffee and see if I brought back the change. Which I did. And that was growth for me. And I went on doing the things they told me to do. Being of service, listening to people, having empathy. You know, I truly believe that empathy is a gift of God. Psychopaths don't have empathy. That's how they're able to commit evil. Because evil, at its very bottom, is a complete and utter lack of empathy. Where they can take someone and do something horrendous and feel absolutely no conscience about it. There's no God there. Because God is bringing me always to another human being and how they feel, if I am in God's world. So I started feeling the empathy, which to me was a gift of grace, because I was willing and truly feeling for other human beings when they were suffering and being able to identify with them. I went on my road doing all... the other thing that I did early on is that when my... I decided that because of the type of drunken mother I had been, when I was with my boys, I would not react to them. I never physically abused my children, but, you know, when they came back to me as big men, they used to call me Napalm. You know, they used to say, "Mommy's Napalm." And that's because I used to react. You know, I had this trigger in me that sometimes would react, and if I didn't like what they did. And I said, no, let me be gentle. Let me practice the gentleness in my home and let it be a gentle place. And then I was given John, my husband, to look after, who was in such devastating shape. And I said, I am going to love this man unconditionally and treat him like a child. And really nurture him and care for him. And that helped me to grow enormously. My spirituality was also based on my defects of character and how well I was able to turn them around. And one of my defects of character, it happened when I was about 8 years sober. It was, I used to be a thief. And I did not steal anymore when I came into AA because I did not want to, because I know it wasn't the spiritual way to be. But, you know, every now and then there's this little thing comes up and you think you can kind of slide by. And to me, the way you know how spiritual, there's an old saying, the spiritual life is as sharp as the edge of a razor. And whatever I was allowed to get away with in the early days of my sobriety, I don't get away with it the more I go in sobriety. And I was buying a cantaloupe. I wanted to buy a cantaloupe. And I went into the store and I said, how much is the cantaloupe? And it was $2.50. I said, I'm not paying $2.50 for a cantaloupe. So I came out and I'm getting up the rest of my groceries, and at the end of the counter is a cantaloupe in a paper bag. I said, it must be God. So I take the cantaloupe home and I eat it. I had $40 in an envelope. Now, keep an open mind. This is the God of my understanding. I had $40 in an envelope for some AA function that somebody had given me. I could not find my $40. I said, God, the cantaloupe was only $2.50. Where's my $40? I could not find it. I have 2 sleepless nights over a cantaloupe. And eventually I called my sponsor. My sponsor said, that was stealing. That wasn't left for you. What's wrong with you? You have to go back and make amends to the store. So I went back to the store and I told the produce manager, I said, I always lie when I'm trying to be honest, you know. And I said... I said to him, I inadvertently took a cantaloupe. I said, and I'd like to pay for it. He said, well, where's the cantaloupe? I said, I ate it. He said, well, we cannot take produce back, and we can't take your money if you don't have the produce, but thank you for your honesty. And I went home, and I found the $40. That is a simplistic way of putting the way it was an experience I went through, but it had so much more meaning for me. And it means if I am going on the spiritual path, then everything seems to work out okay for me. If I am not going on the spiritual path, nothing works well. It's like I'm falling into potholes and I end up trying to put the proverbial round peg in the square hole. And it's not working out for me. So the spiritual life for me, the other thing I did was, it's only 3 months ago I got identical. And the only reason I got identical was because of all these advertisers now that are calling all the time. And there was a spiritual reason why I did not get identical, and that was I was not going to monitor my phone calls. I absolutely refused to monitor my phone calls because I saw people do it. And if I'm meant to be a member of AA and a member of a spiritual fellowship, I have to be forever available. There have been times when I have had to cancel a couple of commitments because of either family or health. But I have always let the person know. And I have suffered greatly because I had to. I mean, I just couldn't go, but it just didn't sit well with me that I hadn't kept my commitment. And I try always now. It's been quite a long time since I didn't keep a commitment. What happens in the spiritual life when you're not well? When you get a diagnosis of an illness? What happens to your spiritual life when a spouse dies? Or, God forbid, a child dies? Sometimes when I've had something that's caused me grief, I get to a place that I call the moment between trapezes. You know the trapezes? And you have an acrobat on there. And he has to let go in order to grab onto the next one. There's a moment there where he has faith that he will reach the other one. And what has happened to me through taking the directions and instructions that I have taken and seeking this spiritual life is I have gone from having absolute and complete knowledge of God's presence in my life. I know, like Jung, I know there's a God. But I've also been able to develop faith because I know that God is going to hold me when I cannot walk myself. And that has been proven to me over and over and over again. There has been times in my sobriety when I have reached that place that I call the cloud of unknowing. The cloud of unknowing comes from a book written by an anonymous person. It must have been a mystic. 14th century Christianity, found in Britain. And the cloud of unknowing is about also the moments when we don't truly think God is there for us. And it's also about suspending all disbelief and just saying to myself, that God, I know your presence is with me. It doesn't matter how I feel right now. I know you are always with me. And I'll close with this. I spent a lot of time in mental institutions. I had a lot of diagnoses. I was not well. Since coming into Alcoholics Anonymous on the 10th of August, 1984, I have not had medication. From I was 13 years old, I suffered panic attacks that are beyond explanation. I cannot explain to you the horror and terror of those panic attacks that came of their own volition from somewhere inside of me. And they would be with me, I'd be fine, and I'd be sitting on a bus, and they'd suddenly come, and I'd have to jump off the bus. I'd be with people and they would come up and I'd have to run screaming out a room. It was the horror. To me, it was the horror. Since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, there has only been twice when I have been under a lot of stress about something, when I have felt for a moment that they are coming. And I just ask God to help me and give me strength and take it away. And he has. And that is another knowledge of God, this magnificent God that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.
I thought that was pretty swell. How about you?
Yeah.
Anybody else up here have anything else to say in rebuttal? No? Okay, we're on the path. We have 20 minutes, and we'd love to have questions if you've got them. Some of us up here are not as patient as others of us. Marianne.